This episode contains depictions of violence that some may find triggering or disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome back, Laura.
Oh, thank you.
As if I've been holding up the fort much without you. One listener story.
I know.
How are you feeling?
To be honest, I think I've moved past the actual COVID part. Okay. And I think I've moved into the post-COVID part now. Still very congested. Still have a cough. Still very like lightheaded, and like can't get up and move around for too long without like the lightheadedness getting worse.
Wow.
And on like the more I do have to do, like move around, you know, that point of being so tired, you reach kind of delirium.
Yeah.
I feel anytime I have to get up and do something, that's my headspace. And caught myself like as I was preparing for this and had to like, Graham's been great with doing, not helping around the house, because if you saw my house right now, yikes, but with doing the animals, anything that like is dependent on others for life, he's great with.
That's good.
But he woke up late this morning, so I had to go do the animals, and I came back in and I was so out of it. I was having a full-blown conversation with myself and like reassuring myself that yes, indeed, the water needs to be refilled and that it's going to be quite heavy for me to do, and I'm going to see if I can hold out for as long as I can. it was a great long conversation. But yeah, I'm thankful my voice is back. It's like still
good.
The longer I talk, like the tail end of it just gets kind of tired. And it gets that like kind of sound to it. But for a while there, I was legitimately worried it was never going to come back to normal. I was like, this is going to be my voice forever. And I'm not going to be able to do a podcast. Graham's like, it'll be fine. People will still listen. I'm like, if it's a completely different podcast, listen to this bitch talk.
No, I mean, you know, I think considering you sound pretty good to me, your voice does not sound non-Laura-ish.
Well, I had plenty of time to rest it. Graham, that's good. Had to go back to work pretty quickly after I tested positive. They, on day 5, they're like, you still negative? Okay, great, come back in. And he's still negative.
All the work rules with COVID are so weird, and it's different. I feel like employer to employer.
Yep.
For Gavin's work, he was like texting his coworker late at night, checking in, because it sounds like for Gavin's work, they have to jump through so many hoops to be able to return to work, though. So it's kind of like the opposite of they're like extremely cautious, which is great, but I think it's frustrating for Gavin because there's been with this like COVID surge, it's just become like he's like in a staffing nightmare. He's like, oh, he's short staffed, trying to figure out who's in, who's out, and as soon as somebody comes back in, there's somebody else who has to stay home, whether they have COVID or not. But I don't know what our employer
ours is
like, since
you have to fill out a form, which I still have to send in because my printer isn't working and they don't have like a digital way for you to fill it out, which I think is stupid in the year 2022. But it's like a leave of absence, kind of. You let them know when you think you'll be back. And there's 80 hours of COVID leave pay.
Oh, for the year?
Yeah, I think it's for the year. So if I get it again, tough luck, but it's been nice to not have to stress about, oh my God, I gotta get back.
That sounds pretty generous to me, I think, compared to what I've heard from employers of, you know, other friends where they get like one day paid off.
Right.
If they do test positive for COVID. So that's nice to know that we have like this kind of 80-hour bank for the year. I did not know that.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, mine, I used mine beginning the first because I worked like an hour that morning and then tested positive and I was like, wait. So I technically have until this upcoming Wednesday if I feel like I still need a little bit more rest, but there is that pressure too of, with my team specifically knowing.
Right.
Ugh.
Well, I'm glad that, hi Fitz. I'm glad that you're, you know, more active and that you're able to do the pod. I know so many people have been missing us. There's even somebody on our on our like Patreons only group that was like, where are you guys? I hope everything's okay.
Yes. Well, it was a busy month, May, but it was also, we took time to recalibrate the podcast, how we envision things, how we want to do things moving forward. Because obviously, you know, when things do come up, I mean, we both work very full time and we both have a lot going on outside of our work lives, even just our personal lives. And, you know, you got married, but you also have an international wedding coming up.
Yeah.
And,
that's right.
You know, I've had setbacks, you know, mental health, physical health kind of stuff. And so we wanted to recalibrate with thinking how best to still provide what we provide while also making sure we're taking care of ourselves and working smarter and also taking into account our lovely growing patrons.
Yeah. Yeah, patrons.
So we took the month kind of to discuss all that.
Yeah.
So there will be some changes moving forward. I don't know if you discussed. I didn't get to listen to the listeners. I don't know.
Yes, I only teased it that we're going to be introducing some new things for the podcast going forward. And with that is a little bit of a new format. It's not going to be much different. It's not like we're like changing the podcast. Really, it's more of like, I think we discussed kind of the cadence and the schedule. So one of those things is that we're very well known for trying to post an episode on Witchy Wednesdays. And I think with so many months of us trying to get those episodes posted on a Wednesday, it just kind of... we're kind of like, okay, maybe Wednesdays don't work for us. Yeah. And how our schedules were like and are like. So we are going to shift to our episodes coming out on Sundays instead.
Yes.
Which will be kind of nice because some of my favorite podcasts, their episodes come out Sunday. And even though I don't listen on Sunday, it's always such a nice treat for like Monday to have like start off the week with like... a new episode. So
yeah, it leaves hopefully... a whole week to kind of find time to listen versus waiting midweek for something new. And
then also kind of, I think, hopefully this I'm pretty sure this will be a better day for us to shoot to get a podcast out because since it comes out on a Sunday, it gives me, you know, in theory, I would edit it, you know, a few days early or whatever, a week early, and then schedule it to be published. But worst case, then I have Saturday, which are usually pretty open for me,
Exactly.
To edit and get it all set up for it to publish on
Saturday is
Sunday.
A much better, like, last minute day to have versus Tuesday.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Because I'm not so much a person that, like, I always have something new going on the weekends. I kind of keep my weekends open unless, of course, there's, like, a friend's birthday or anything. So, and I think you're pretty similar. Whereas I feel like my best friend, Marie with the good hair, she schedules all her weekends out, like, months ahead. Like, she always has something going on. I cannot be that person.
Well, she's
I don't
a
know
Leo.
How she does it. She is a Leo, that's why.
I feel like Bree's the same way. It's like, I'll be like, when are you free? Are you free this weekend? Oh, no, I've got da 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 da. Okay, well, the next weekend.
You gotta get penciled in to see your own best friend. Yeah, we have to, like, me and Maria have to schedule a get together where we see each other maybe a week or more in advance. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, it's just like how she lives her life, right?
Yeah.
It's just how she operates.
It's
and
how
it's
fire
fine.
Moves.
It's just very it's just very different from how I operate.
We're earth. We're trees. We yeah. are what we are. We stay put.
We should have an offshoot, like, spin-off podcast where it's like two earth signs with Leo best friends and what that's like. So that's one change that we're doing. The other change is, I mean, for the most part, we're still going to be a weekly-ish
yes.
podcast. Do you want to kind of walk them through that change?
So we're still going to be weekly. It'll be every Sunday. But what we're doing to make it a little bit easier on ourselves and our time, but still provide what we provide, is we are now switching, rather than constantly going back and forth between witchy, spooky, you know, if we skip one, we, you know, cover it the next time. We are now officially changing it to, there will be 4 episodes a month every Sunday. Mm-hmm. If there happens to be a 5th Sunday, there won't be an episode.
We're taking
that
off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Built-in break. And along with that, what we are doing is the first Sunday will be witchy, second will be spooky, third will be another witchy, and the fourth will be our listeners episode.
Yeah.
So yeah. That way you're still getting everything. It's just going to, like I said, be a little bit easier on us. And then the other thing that we're doing for the spooky is, rather than kind of combining two different stories into one, we are going to just focus on one spooky story per spooky mm-hmm. episode, and we will be switching off who shares.
Oh my god. Did you see that?
I saw and heard it.
So that was Fitz was like sitting, I'm recording from bed, and Fitz was sitting by me in bed, and then just decided to scale my upholstered headboard that's right next to the mic. Yeah, I can tell he wants attention, he wants playtime.
Yeah.
But, I'm recording, son. Now he's like, I'm up here and I don't know what to do. He just keeps going back and forth.
He's like, go back.
I didn't think this through.
I'll go forward.
Oh, God.
All right, go forward. Almost fell.
Do not jump on the... Well, he's down now. No. Devil child. Okay. He's going to his end of the bed. Leave me alone. Okay. Love you. Okay. Sorry. Whenever he's being, like, bad, that's our favorite nickname for him is Devil Child.
I'm so sorry. I keep coughing. It's going to keep happening. I apologize. So we're going to do the one spooky. So it will work out to be one specifically spooky episode a month, mm-hmm. but it will give us the ability for one person to put their time and effort into the episode versus both of us trying to, you know, fill our portions of it. So I think it'll make for a better episode, a little bit more dedicated.
And then also kind of open up the ability for whoever does have like the spooky episode for that mm-hmm. time to do a deeper dive on the story.
Exactly. And what I'm most because excited we always, like, for. Oh, yeah. No, go for it.
I was going to say, like, I feel like when we do our spooky episodes, yes, obviously, like, we have sometimes done deep dives where we do, like, part one, part two, or right. we'll just, you know, like, say screw it and we'll talk for over an hour for just our portion. But mm-hmm. we do, for the most part, try to be respectful of leaving room for the other person's story and not just hogging the airwaves. Right. But this might be... I mean, I think it will, I believe it will be like a nice kind of one, a respite for us
yeah.
and kind of lessen the workload and to allow for those really cool, like full on deep dives where our listeners can be along with us and just focusing on one story. Mm-hmm. Or if it's like an anthology of stories like you did for like the UFO episode that a while right. back. And those are really cool too. But yeah.
I think... What I was going to say is what I'm most excited for is I think it'll also leave a door open for potential interviews with,
oh yeah,
you know, either a specialist in something or, I don't know. My mind literally mm-hmm. just went blank, but you get the gist.
Yes. Someone's like we've spooky. Definitely brought in people to interview for Witchy, but on our bucket list has definitely been to bring on somebody to interview for Spooky.
Yeah.
And, yeah. And, I know that we're going to be also focusing, a little more on paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
We will still like include some true crime elements. It's not like true crime is off the table.
Right.
A lot of stories that are paranormal have some sort of true crime built into it.
Yeah.
But anyways, we're just going to experiment and go forward with this kind of format. So again, first Sunday of the month, witchy, second Sunday, spooky, third Sunday, witchy again. And then that fourth is going to be our listener stories. So it mm-hmm. won't fall on the 13th anymore. So you guys actually will still get like an extra injection of spooky. It'll just come from fellow listeners.
Yes. Firsthand spooky.
Yeah. So, yay. And I think that will just help ease a lot of the workload for us too, and also help us to focus on things that are good for our mental health. And also, mm-hmm. you know, we're looking forward to giving our patrons a little more love on Patreon. And yeah. so that also opens up the bandwidth for that.
Yeah. And that's going to be a part two in what, you know, explaining what we'll be doing, but that will be for our Patreon members first. Mm-hmm. And then we'll let you guys know what the new goodies are.
Yeah. TBD. So should we kick off today's episode?
Yeah, let's do
topic. So today is a spooky episode, and while I did tease that we'll be doing less true crime, I am covering quite a true crime case. And today I'm discussing the very gruesome, but also very bizarre, controversial case of Darlie Routier.
Okay.
And the murder of her two young boys.
Oh.
This case, I forget how I happened upon it because I wrote the notes for this like over a month ago. But I just remember like becoming enthralled in it because it's one of those cases where you don't know which way is up.
Oh, okay.
You don't know if Darlie, the mother, and the convicted suspect is indeed the murderer or if she was incidentally framed and now stands on death row.
Oh.
For this.
Okay.
So I kind of tease kind of what happens to Darlie, but I'll kind of start from the beginning. So Darlie Routier, we're going to bring things and start it the evening before the murders went down.
Okay.
So it's June 5th, the year is 1996, and we're in Rowlett, Texas. This is like a bedroom community suburb of Dallas, for kind of geography. And Darlie and her husband, Darren, they live in a gorgeous, like, newly built home in a very affluent area. I forget what the neighborhood is called, but if you see photos of this home, it's spectacular. Like, they were 26 and I forget. Darlie was 26. Darren was 20, I think, like, a couple years older than her or something. Okay. And it's this gorgeous, ginormous, like, colonial style home with, like, the brick and the symmetrical windows and, like, the three gables on the roof. Like, just gorgeous. So Darlie was a stay-at-home mom. And she had three boys. The oldest was Devin, who was 6. There was Damon, who was 5. And the new baby addition was Drake. So he was less than a year old, months old.
Baby Drake. Baby Drake. I love baby when people Drake. Name their babies things that are like, when you're an adult, it makes sense. But as a baby, it's kind of like Steve, you know, names like that. I love it.
Oh, man. That's interesting. That's kind of similar to, isn't the Magnolia people, their, like, youngest is, or they have a son named, like, Duke. Like a name like that is kind of, like, as a kid, that's, like, a strong name.
Who are the Magnolia people?
Oh, sorry. Like, Fixer Upper. The Fixer Upper people. Joanna and Chip Gaines. That they'd have, like, shiplap everywhere. Giant kitchen island here. Tear down all the walls. Shiplap, shiplap, shiplap. Those people. They have, like,
I think I don't girls. Watch that because I don't have a lot of money and I feel very left out.
Oh, well, they're, you know, they have, like, a bajillion children. They have three boys. And
one of them has an adult name.
Yeah, it's, yeah, one of them I'm pretty sure is called Duke. I could totally be wrong, but
Baby Duke.
Yeah, one of those names where you're like a little kid and, hi, I'm Duke. And then, like, he'll grow into his name.
Shut up, Duke.
But it is a pretty cute, like, boy name, though.
Yeah, I think it's super cute.
But anyways, so on this night of June 5th, 1996, there's a couple differing stories. So I have listened to various podcast episodes. I've watched different TV specials on this case. And the reason for Darlie and the two older boys camping out in the living room that night differs. Either it was that Darlie was a light sleeper and she had already been sleeping out in the living room actually for weeks, because even the sound of baby Drake would like him just getting up and readjusting in his own crib, that would wake her up.
Oh.
So that's one story, that she was already there for weeks. And then they decided, like, oh, boys, like, let's have a fun living room camp out. And then other stories are like that it was a
sleep, like, worse if she's around three sleeping boys.
Yeah, honestly, that's one aspect of the story that doesn't really line up.
Okay.
That it seems like she was definitely a light sleeper. But it seems that, for context, she had already been sleeping in the downstairs living room for a couple weeks, or at least quite a few days. And then, but this particular night, the boys joined her because it was, like, a very hot night.
Okay.
And the downstairs was cooler.
Yeah.
And they were trying to escape the heat. So the two boys, Devin and I almost said Drake, but that's the youngest. Devin and Damon, they sleep downstairs with their mom and they have, like, a fun time. They're watching TV and they fall asleep watching TV. The father, Darren, and the baby are upstairs in the main room. So while the boys are sleeping, apparently Darlie and Darren, like, have a chat. They talk about some finances. Darlie has a trip to Mexico coming up, this and that. Like, bills, kind of, like, you know, boring homeowner / adult stuff.
Was it a work trip or a girls' trip?
No, it was, like, a girls' trip.
Fun.
Because Darlie didn't work. She did some accounting for Darren's business. He was in like computer parts. Like his company made circuit boards, which is how they made a lot of their money very quickly. But then once they made enough money, she was a stay-at-home mom. So at this point, she wasn't working anymore. So Darren says that he fell asleep between midnight or 1 a.m. And he says that about an hour later, he woke up to Darlie screaming his son's name. And he, I mean, just like blood-curdling scream. He runs down the stairs and finds Darlie waiting for him at the bottom of the stairs. And she's on the phone with police. And he surveys the scene and he sees that Devin, the oldest, is laying face up, just staring at the ceiling. He goes to Devin. He's unresponsive. He performs CPR and Darren recalls that just the first breath of CPR that he gave Devin, just blood and air spurted out from his chest. Oh, God. And that there were stab wounds to his chest. He sees that Darlie is covered in blood, makes the phone call to 911 about 2:31 a.m. Or I guess not about, but that was the time that she called. And seeing that, he kind of makes this split second decision of like, he knows that Devin is gone. So he goes then to Damon, who's to the side, and he's actually face down, and he has several stab wounds on his back. And Darlie, while speaking on the phone with the 911 dispatcher, is telling Damon to just hold on, baby, be strong. And his last words were, okay, mom, I'll try. Police arrive in minutes. They see that Darlie's throat is slashed and she has a huge gash on her forearm.
Wait, I think I saw an episode of Unsolved Mysteries of the story.
Oh, maybe. Because, I mean, it's one of those things where, like, this was taken to trial. Darlie was convicted, but there
are... It doesn't quite add up. There's something kind of weird about it. Nothing adds up.
Again...
Yes.
As you go along, 12. you go between, I go back and forth between like, she did it. There's no way that she could do it. No, she did it. No, there's no way that she could have done it. Like, it just goes back and forth. It's an odd, odd case.
Yeah. Okay.
So police arrive. They find Darlie hysterical, still on the phone with the dispatcher. She's, you know, bleeding from these two different wounds. Devin was dead upon arrival or dead on arrival. And Damon was taken into the ambulance, but he died on the way to the hospital. Darlie was also in an ambulance, and once they cart her off, they turn over the house to police. And the police immediately start suspecting that something's wrong. They say that the scene is bizarre. What seemed like per... Darlie's account that somebody came in and stabbed her boys, they're like, okay, so this was a robbery gone wrong, if you just hear that story. But when surveying everything, nothing's missing. There's one broken glass, one vacuum knocked over, and a window screen in the garage that has been slashed. But Darlie, like, again, like, the routiers were making really good money, and Darlie definitely spent it. She had, like, very, I wouldn't say gaudy, but just, like, very flashy, like, beautiful jewelry, and all. She wore all these, like, gorgeous rings, and she had them just, like, laying out there, like, on a jewelry dish. And none of those things were taken. Like, nothing was taken from the home. If this was a robbery, they'd got away with really nothing. Right. And yeah, so like all the valuables were in plain sight, untouched, and police needed Darlie to fill in some missing pieces. But she was in the hospital for 2 days for surgery for her neck injury. So nurses and clinicians that attended to Darlie, their statements are a little inconsistent. They reported her being either totally devastated mother that she was heartbroken, or that she was acting strange and unexpected for a mother who just lost two sons.
Which those are very subjective descriptions. You would think nurses right? should be used to giving something a little bit more objective. You know?
Yes. Their notes tend to be that way. They should have. One thing to consider with this case is the lens that the media made everyone see this through. And it definitely cast a particular vibe. And whether it was accurate or not, you guys will decide at the end. But, mm-hmm. you know, these, a lot of people that were then like interviewed and stuff had already been exposed to the media and what the media was saying and what the police were saying. Because the police were kind of right on Darlie right away. And in my opinion, didn't do much to look into any other options mm-hmm. other than Darlie being the murderer. Right. But anyways, Darlie was released from the hospital on June 8th. They took her statement, and the next thing she remembers per her statement is, you know, pretty much what I said in the beginning. That was from Darren's statement. Uh-huh. So everything about that is pretty consistent, but we don't know much about, like, well, what happened when she woke up? Like, what led to Darlie screaming her son's name and then Darren coming down the stairs. Mm-hmm. So per her statement, you know, she fell asleep with the boys watching TV. The TV was like on, there was like, you know, like the white static or whatever. And she remembers feeling pressure on her shoulder and hearing Damon saying like mommy and kind of whimpering and crying. She woke up and she said that she saw a man standing next to her on the couch at her feet, like walking away from her, which differs from the very initial statement that she just gave police when they first came on the scene, that she awoke from a person violently attacking her. Mm-hmm. So very first one, she's like, oh, they violently attacked me and they stabbed my boys. Now in this more formal voluntary statement after surgery, she says which I find a little odd, that this guy is just calmly like walking away. Mm-hmm. She says that after she sees this guy walking, that she hears a piece of glass shattering. She starts chasing after this guy in the dark, then doubles back to turn on a light, keeps following him from the living room to the kitchen. And then through the kitchen, there is kind of a utility room that kind of is like this medium area between the kitchen and the garage. Mm-hmm. When she approaches the utility room, she finds the knife that the perpetrator apparently dropped on the floor before fleeing, and she instinctively picks it up. And then when she sees that the guy has made himself scarce, she doesn't see him anymore, like he's gotten away. She goes back to the living room, sees that Devin is facing up with his eye open, unresponsive, like dead, presumably. And that, you know, Damon is also very badly injured. And then that's when she starts screaming for her husband. Which then kind of is another point that police kind of get hung up on, that she says that she was calling Darren's name. But like, if Darren heard Devin and he was just like woken up from a deep sleep, Darren and Devin kind of sound the same, especially when you're hysterical mm-hmm. and screaming. So police are suspicious of Darlie almost from the start, as I said. There is an inconsistency with the story about the knife. So she said that she found the knife on the floor that the guy dropped and that she picked it up. She did eventually set that knife down on the kitchen counter, and there was, you know, blood from the knife, like blood markings from the knife when she set it down on the counter. The same consistent markings were found on the carpet as well, from I guess a point where the knife must have fallen on the carpet bloody. Mm-hmm. But there was no blood evidence whatsoever that the knife fell on the floor in the utility room where she says. Mm-hmm. They even experimented, like the crime scene investigators, they ordered, like, you know, a couple of units of blood, got a very similar knife and dipped it in the blood, and then they dropped it at different heights, at different angles, and it all kind of made a very consistent, like, kind of V-marked shape from, like, the impact of it hitting on the floor. Mm-hmm. And they didn't see any markings like that whatsoever. There's also Darlie's bloody footprints that were found that were consistent with her saying that she walked through the kitchen. But then sometimes she said that she was running through the kitchen chasing after this guy. But her strides, per the footprints, are consistent with her just walking through. And who just calmly walks through following a guy in pursuit that just stabbed your boys and was attacking you? Mm-hmm. On top of that, the broken glass, the one wine glass that was shattered, one of the very few things that was, you know, I don't know, vandalized is the right word, but just like broken from, you know, the struggle or the right. Whatever happened in the scene. The glass was found on top of her bloody footprints. And there was no blood on the glass. Mm-hmm. Fitz, stop. Those are cords. You will be electrocuted. He wants attention so bad. Okay. I'm so sorry. And another point with her picking up the knife is that during the call, she tells the dispatcher that she touched the knife, and she's, obviously I'm paraphrasing, but she says, oh no, like we could have gotten like the person's fingerprints. Like she gets fixated on that. And a lot of people found that very weird, as if she was voluntarily pointing it out to mm-hmm. present it as an excuse why you would not find anybody else's prints on it. They're like, oh, I already compromised the evidence on the knife. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she says something like, I wonder if we could have gotten the prints maybe. In the call, she never asks what she can do to help the boys. She just says that her kids are dying or that they're dead. She then shifts the attention on herself when she realizes on the phone that she herself is injured. And she's like, oh my God, I think I'm dying. Which a lot of people say, like, as a mother, like, I wouldn't care about myself. I could be dying and I wouldn't shift the attention and start victimizing myself right away. There's a lot of, like, if you do research on this, there's a lot of, I think, analysis, maybe hyper-analysis right. on this call. And then there's also the question of, like, how does she sleep through her two boys being stabbed if she was a light sleeper?
Right.
And I mean, these boys were stabbed almost through and through the chest. I mean, yes, they were small boys, but, like, the knife, like, it just went straight through them. Mm-hmm. And she the only thing that wakes her up is, like, Damon's whimpering. Like, those boys probably were screaming unless they were stabbed in the dead of them being asleep, but it just doesn't seem very likely. Mm-hmm. There's also the matter of the injuries that she sustained, and they were major. She had to, you know, go into surgery. Mm-hmm. She went into, like, the trauma unit of... Oh, Fitz, oh my God, come on, dude. Get out. I love you. Get out. No. Come here. Oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, my child. My fur child just being a little brat right now. Okay. So these injuries, at first, they were, like, they were superficial, but no, like, she did sustain very serious injuries. There's the gash on her neck, and then the very deep wound on her forearm. However, in her statement, she says that she was attacked on the couch. Like, the struggle didn't happen elsewhere. Like, she says that it was on the couch that she sustained these injuries. But there was very little blood on the couch. Most of the blood from Darlie was found in the kitchen sink. Even more fishy was when they were investigating the crime scene. There was a ton of blood, like, on the counter and falling into the sink, but they did spray the whole sink down with luminol, which, if you don't know, causes a chemical reaction and causes any traces of blood to glow. And that thing lit up like a Christmas tree. And it showed that there was a lot of blood that washed down the sink. Mm-hmm. That, like, who... It suggested, potentially, that she self-inflicted her wounds over the sink. And then that she also washed it down with water, mm-hmm. which is not something that you would logically, rationally do.
But at the same time, to slit your throat, to do it in a way where you survive it, but it's bad enough that you have to go have surgery, that's a pretty heavy risk one way or the other.
It was pretty bad. People say, like, well, she wanted it to look very convincing, so she did, like, go intense on herself, but didn't realize that she almost died because the gash on her neck, it was, I mean, I'll get into it in a little bit, but, yeah, there's arguments both ways, but I just don't see. She also has, like, insane bruises. Mm-hmm. Like... from her wrist all the way to her armpit, her arm is purple. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know what kind of self-infliction could cause that kind of bruising. Mm-hmm. And it's not like some spots of bruises where she could have, like, punched her own arm. I mean, it was... there's actually... I have photos in my notes that if you scroll down, I think it's page 6. There's photos of her injuries. Another thing that was a little fishy was the cut screen in the garage. There's a couple windows, and one of those big windows, the screen was cut vertically down. And they say that, like, well, perps don't really cut screens. If you're a seasoned perp, you know that those things, they can just pop off from the window frame. That you don't really have to cut through them. Mm-hmm. They also said that the layer of dust on the windowsill was undisturbed. And they argued that mulch that was under the window outside in the home, there was no disturbance, there was no footprints. But there's also flaws to that theory as well, which I'll get to. They did find a bread knife in the knife block where the butcher knife that killed the boys is from. They found fiberglass rods on this bread knife that would be the same compound as what's found in window screens. Oh. So now it didn't say that those fiberglass rods were from that window screen, but it's the same compound as what it's made out of. However, you do have to consider that these fibers weren't something that you could easily see to the naked eye. It wasn't like pieces of the screen.
Right.
These fibers were one strand of your hair, and it was a tenth thickness of that. So teeny tiny, like microscopic. But nonetheless, the police were very convinced that Darlie was guilty of murder. But then you ask, okay, if she did it, why?
Right.
Why did she kill her boys? They thought that the motive was for financial freedom to maintain her lavish lifestyle. So Darlie and Darren, they were upper middle class. Darren made very good money from his computer parts company. But under the surface, they actually were slowly racking up debt. At that time, it was $22,000 of debt. Darlie had not slowed down her spending, her shopping. She had that trip to Mexico coming up that was obviously it wasn't like a necessary trip. It was just like a girl's trip. Mm-hmm. And when asked about, you know, if you guys were in debt, why didn't you stop your spending? And she's like, well, I wasn't worried. You know, we just thought that there was a dip in the business, but that it would go back up. And Darren assured me that we would be okay. But, you know, police say, like, well, you know, she saw the boys as a financial burden, and they did find a note in her diary that they think proved that Darlie not only murdered her boys, but that it was premeditated. Mm-hmm. In her diary about a month before this all went down, she wrote, "I'm sorry for what I'm about to do." But that line in her diary was taken out of context.
Right. I was going to say.
One part of a sentence was like brought to the trial. Darlie, you have to consider that she was actually going through partum depression and postpartum depression.
Mm-hmm.
And when you read the entire entry, it reads way more that she was thinking of killing herself.
Mm.
And she wrote something to the effect of, Devin, Damon, and Drake, I hope you can one day find it in your hearts to forgive me. I'm sorry for what I'm about to do. And then she continues on, I just don't think I can go on much longer.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't read much of like somebody that's about to murder her kids to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, right? And it also, if like you know that you're killing your kids, it's not like, I hope that someday you can forgive me. If they're not alive,
yeah,
they're not going to have a someday. And nonetheless, police have the home under investigation June 6th. So Darlie released from the hospital on the 8th. They get her voluntary statement. They hold a service for the boys on June 9th. And then comes what's known as the silly string video, which would be the proverbial nail in the coffin for the case against Darlie. And this is how a lot of people actually know this case, is the silly string video.
Mm-hmm.
So on June 14th, what would have been Devin's 7th birthday, they had a graveside celebration. News outlets came out to film. People were jovial. Darlie was laughing. And they sprayed a bunch of silly string on the grave and over like the balloons and stuff. And it just, she was like chewing gum and she was like laughing. And it was just not a good look.
Right.
She was also chewing gum during her interview, smiling, saying that the boys wouldn't want them to be sad and that, you know, we have to find some light to try to like make it through the day and go on.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, especially people who are parents, were like, I would never act like that. It just disturbed a lot of people. So when called into the station to go over her voluntary statement, the police say, you know, your story's not really adding up, and outright accuses her of murdering her two boys. They say, Darlie, we think you're the one who did this. And for a typical response would be something, I think, like, how dare you? I would never kill my boys. Yada, yada. Like, how could you think that? I loved those boys. Her response is, if I did kill them, then I don't remember.
What was her tone with that?
I didn't listen to the recording, just read the transcript of it.
Because mm-hmm. I could but see that was, going a number of ways. If it was said right, like incredulously, well, if I did kill them, then I don't remember. Like, I could see that, but, you know, I don't know.
But she doesn't, like, defend herself much other than that is what's mm-hmm. odd. She just, like, leaves it as that's enough of a statement of saying that I didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Where I feel like there would at least be some sort of like, you would be offended or you would just really hold on to like, I did not do this.
Mm-hmm.
And on June 17th, police released the house to the routiers. And then the next day she is arrested. Darlie said that she did feel blindsided. And even though they're like, we think that you did it. When they communicated the police with Darren and Darlie, they were like, you know, skin under your fingernails. We're going to take that and work with that, blah, blah, blah. And kind of led them on to think that they were more trying to investigate you know, following the story of the intruder. When really, actually, the whole time, they were really zeroing in on Darlie. So she felt very blindsided. And even with them accusing her of, in that interrogation, she really didn't think that she would be the one to end up behind bars.
Mm-hmm.
So the prosecution, actually, she was charged with the murder of only Damon, which people found interesting, but it was a tactic of the prosecution, because if they couldn't charge her for Damon's murder, then they still, or for Devin's murder, I'm sorry. Hold on.
Then they would get her for the other.
Devin, Damon. Okay. Yeah, it was Damon's murder, the 5-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And if they didn't get her on Damon's murder, then they would go after her for Devin's. And there was also a law in Texas, at least at the time, that if you were to kill somebody under the age of 6, it would be a capital offense.
Mm-hmm.
Versus if they led with Devin, she wouldn't have gotten like the most severe.
Right.
So anyways, the prosecution showed the jury things, all the things that I said that kind of don't add up. They show the silly string video. They also talk about this sock that they found down an alleyway from the Routier's home.
Oh, I remember the story of the sock in the episode.
Yes. So there's this like, just kind of like one of those like white gym socks.
Mm-hmm.
And it was bloody, not super bloody, but there was blood, both Damon and Devin's blood found on it. And I forget how many yards away, it was quite a few yards, but they're like, you know, she staged it and then she went and grabbed the sock and made sure that both of the boys' bloods were on it and then dropped it off in this alleyway and then came back, and then that's when she called. They show the silly string video. And the jury asked to see this video during deliberation. They rewatched it again and again. They watched it a total of 11 times.
Hmm.
And this is what helped them decide that Darlie was a cold-blooded murderer, and they sentenced her to death.
Which is
one side of the story.
Bizarre. Even if she did do it, I think there's enough reasonable doubt.
Right?
To not go that far. Like,
yes, I believe so too. I will go into now the other side of things.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to focus on Darlie's side of the story, which for me has me questioning everything.
Right.
So she maintained her innocence. She still maintains her innocence to this day. She and Darren went on talk shows, claimed it was a witch hunt and that evidence was not looked at critically or the jury wasn't given the whole picture. Now, one of the biggest arguments, per the photos that I told you about, her injuries.
Right.
So the slash on her neck and stab on her forearm, which were initially claimed to be superficial in court and self-inflicted. I would personally disagree. And if they were self-inflicted, man, the commitment to the game was just insane.
Right.
But
I don't know that you can do it to yourself unless you're like,
that,
I'm going out.
Unless you tell somebody to do it to you that's right. In on it.
Right.
Right. So that, of course, is a possibility. But I just listen, the cut to her forearm, and it's like on the back of her forearm, like towards her elbow.
Mm-hmm.
It was to the bone and very consistent with a self-defense. Like when someone's stabbing at you, you put your arms up.
Right.
And a knife, you know, clearly landed on her there. Now, the cut on her neck came two millimeters to her carotid artery. 2 millimeters. That's 2 smoking, like rolling papers stacked. That thickness is how close she came to bleeding out and dying. It really should have killed her. And also, the knife was actually, the only reason it didn't hit her artery was because the knife was stopped by a necklace that she was wearing at the time, which had to be surgically removed.
Oh, wow.
So I'm also thinking with that detail with the necklace, if I were to start doing a self-inflicted wound, I would actually like be careful to not do it over where my necklace is.
Yeah.
But someone just like took a gash to her and dug and just embedded that necklace into her neck. Some think that she was actually trying to kill herself. And maybe it was like a murder-suicide. But then why call for Darren or call 911?
Right. And why kill just two boys and not, like, what was the purpose then of taking the two oldest boys and...
Right. Like, so, because honestly, like, I feel like a baby would be, if she were looking at, you know, her kids as burdens, the baby is really the most burdensome.
Right.
And would tie her down, like, the most with, like, her, not that she, like, partied and stuff, but... You know, she went on trips and all of this and liked to entertain and the financials. I don't know. It was, you know, just had to be the two older boys because the baby's crib was upstairs and she didn't want to, you know, I don't know. Anyways, all of her other injuries were never brought up either. They really only like talked about her neck gash and the forearm. But then you look at the photo, you see the bruises.
Right.
Which are like, fuck, how do you get those bruises? Holy crap. There was also markings and bruises on her hands, on her fingers. There are little nicks and cuts that are also consistent with self-defense of somebody trying to grab a blade.
Also, her neck. Does it say anywhere if she was right-handed or left-handed?
So she was right-handed and the gash comes from her right side and then goes towards her left.
Right. Like it, because it's not straight across. So it's like
she would have had to have used her left arm or her left hand.
Yeah.
To do both the neck gash and the forearm, because that was on her right forearm.
Right. Where was her defense team?
Honestly, I think that her defense team tried their best. I think there's another aspect to this that really colored the jury's view and everyone else's view on it. And you ask, like, why were people so quick to believe that Darlie would kill her two boys? Like, everyone was just very willing to, like, yep, we're ready. This makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Not just the police, but media too. And the reason was because of a woman named Susan Smith. 2 years before, in North Carolina, a black man hijacked a car with two kids, and there was this huge search. The mother was Susan Smith, who was driving that car and lost her two children. There was press for 9 days. The community was banding together and doing searches for these children, keeping an eye out for this perp. And she was, you know, Susan and her husband were doing press conferences, pleading for whoever had their kids to bring them back. And then she confesses that she was the one that actually killed them. That she took them to a lake, left them in the car, and let that car roll into the lake while she watched. And that was huge. I mean, it was all over, like, the major news outlets at the time. And so that was only 1 year before the murders, 2 years before the trial for Darlie. And it really did color how the public and the media looked at Darlie.
Right.
There's even plenty of quotes, people saying that Darlie was Texas's Susan Smith. Like, they literally just, you know, totally comparing her to Susan Smith. And people projected their hate for Susan Smith onto Darlie. The prosecution also made a huge deal of Darlie's superficial features, that she had fake boobs, she bleaches her hair, she dresses super lavishly and flashy. She's basically just kind of a total character assassination.
Right.
And once they showed the silly string video, that validated this image that they were painting of her. But what they didn't show was that there was a 2-hour prayer ceremony slash vigil before the birthday party that was very somber, that people were crying and very emotional, including Darlie. And Darlie's mother was the one saying, like, hey, we should hold this birthday celebration for your boys. We need some sort of lightness and laughter and happiness, and we need to put a brave face on for them.
Right.
So she was pretty much going by what people were telling her, that, like, yeah, you know, that is a good idea. Like, let's throw this birthday party. And after 2 hours of, like, sobbing her eyes out, yeah, let's have some levity, please.
Yeah.
And of course, they totally omitted that from existence. So now this is Darlie's side for, like, the pieces of the evidence found mm-hmm. against her. So, for example, the knife on the floor. The human memory is not fully accurate, especially of times of trauma like that.
Right.
And when it's dark and it's, you know, intense. So they're like, maybe she's remembering things incorrectly. That she did pick up the knife because she definitely put it on the counter, and it definitely ended up on the counter at some point. But there was also the mark of the knife on the carpet. Maybe she's misremembering and she actually picked it up from the carpet so that she could have a weapon on her. Was what mm-hmm. she was thinking when she picked it up as she was chasing this guy. And then once the guy left, she was already in the kitchen area, put it down on the counter, then called 911.
Not to mention she was asleep right beforehand. I imagine going from asleep right? to an adrenaline rush of you're being mm-hmm. attacked. That's got to affect mm-hmm. your memory.
Yeah. And then, you know, people were very... very critical about how she offered up that she touched the knife in the phone call. Mm-hmm. People really zeroed in on that and just were like, oh, she's, you know, just right away trying to come up with an excuse of, like, why her prints are on it and why we're not going to find anyone else's stuff or why it's compromised. When you listen to the call and also read the transcript, mm-hmm. she is prompted by the dispatcher to not touch anything. The dispatcher says, don't touch anything. And she says, oh, but I already picked it up. Like, if I were in that moment, I'd be like, well, fuck, I already, you yeah. know, like, you, because you're not thinking fully clearly when you're exactly like in that adrenaline rush.
Right.
She's just thinking, like, I'm going to pick this up so that I have some sort of weapon on me
yeah.
to defend myself as I chase down this guy.
Yeah.
She's not thinking, like, I should leave that on the floor to preserve evidence.
Right.
And then it's when the dispatcher brings up not to touch anything that she realizes, I already picked it up. We could have found the prints. Like, she's thinking, oh my God, like, I just fucked up the chances of finding this perpetrator.
Right.
Now, the blood found below the broken glass. You have to consider that before the crime scene investigators got there, there was a slew of people that came in, including EMTs, that their sole purpose getting there is just preserving the life of
right.
those injured, right? And they were shuffling around. They were attending to two boys and the mother. And the glass could have easily been moved on top of the blood.
Mm-hmm.
That's also why, like, I think the vacuum was also, like, found in a position that was over some blood spatter or blood prints or something.
Mm-hmm.
So that could also, like, they could have moved stuff around to make room for attending to
right.
the victims. Now, the weird evidence of, like, the window, the thing being slashed, like, the layer of dust that was undisturbed in the mulch under the window. Darren actually brought a news outlet out to the house and showed how the flower bed with mulch in it that's under the window, mm-hmm. it's actually like 6 feet over. You can very easily approach that window without ever touching that mulch. Mm-hmm. It's also a kind of window that you wouldn't expect. Like when I was hearing about this window in podcasts before I saw anything visually, I kept imagining just kind of like a window of like a regular height. But this is actually a window that's very low to the floor. Mm. And Darren demonstrated to the news outlet how once the window's open, you can very easily like step in, duck, and then, you know, swing your other leg into the building without ever touching any part of the frame of the window. Mm-hmm. So the undisturbed layer of dust was
moot.
Like that's moot, exactly. The fiberglass rods on the bread knife, it's possible that it was cross-contamination from the fingerprint brushes. Because what they did was that they used it to test the window. And then they used the same brushes to then test the block.
Right.
So those compounds that were consistent with the fiberglass rods also are consistent compounds in brushes. Mm-hmm. And the fibers were not really tested against anything. They really were just said like, yeah, you can find this compound in the fiberglass rods of the screen. And that's where they like ended their search. Mm-hmm. So I would say like you said, like there is enough to give reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
And there was actually a couple of prints that were not identified that did not match Darlie and Darren. And unfortunately, this is something that was an oversight. They never took prints from the boys. They never took them, which is like something that you got to do.
Yeah.
So we don't know if maybe these prints were from the boys or from somebody from outside the home. This would be known as print 85J, and it actually, to this day, we're still waiting on results, DNA results from this print to determine whether it was one of the routiers or if it was from somebody outside the home.
How are we which still would waiting totally, on that?
We're still waiting. Well, you know what? It's insane. So there's been a lot of appeals made.
Good.
To, I mean, I think like this case happened in 96. Mm-hmm. And we're in 2022, and science has just developed so much in like forensics. So as these new technologies and testing has become available, Darlie's defense team has made appeals to get these pieces of evidence retested. Mm-hmm. However, I believe they asked for this to get tested like a few years ago, and they're still waiting on it. I don't know why it takes so long. I don't know anything about the process of extracting DNA from this, how long it takes. I'm not an expert on this, but it does seem funny that it's been years and we're still waiting on the results.
Because it's Texas. Yeah, they have a woman maybe in prison. I feel like I'm biased.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we do want to try to consider both sides, but I just think with the amount of reasonable doubt, we really do have to consider how much of the story against Darlie even has any ground to stand on.
Oh, no. And then absolutely.
Right? Yeah. There are just pieces of it that just, like, don't make sense. Like, I get it. Like, if it wasn't Darlie, then who was it? But there's enough reasonable doubt to consider if it was Darlie at all.
She,
you know,
couldn't be on death row with the level of,
and you have to consider
doubt
that the public was absolutely outraged. Again, the thing with the Susan Smith story, yeah, painting this whole like the vibe of this whole how the media saw her, and the public wanting to see somebody convicted of this. Mm-hmm. And police often feel the pressure to convict somebody. Mm-hmm. Whether it's actually the person or not, we've seen that time and time again.
Yep.
And you also have to consider that Rowlett, Texas, nothing bad happened here. Maybe some robberies, but definitely not a gruesome murder. They were I'm not going to say incompetent. I'm not going to say that far.
They're not.
But this was not something that they were used to handling and did not have the same resources as police, like from Dallas, from like a major city. Like this was a sleepy bedroom community outside of Dallas that was very affluent, and very few horrible things happened there. Like that's why people moved there, because nothing bad happened in Rowlett, Texas. So anyway, so I mentioned the sock that was found in an alleyway. So it was found 75 yards away next to a trash can above a drainage opening. Just one sock with blood on it that tested positive for both the boys' blood. And for me, at least, that proves that somebody else ran out of the house. People against Darlie, including, you know, the police, say that she planted it to take away suspicion off of her, but the timing doesn't add up. Damon's injuries, the one boy who was still alive when paramedics arrived, according to a paramedic, and with the because of the injuries that Damon sustained, it gave him 8 to 9 minutes to live from the time that he sustained those injuries. So you're telling me that Darlie has 8 to 9 minutes. You have to consider, like, 911 call was just under 6 minutes, which means that she had, let's say, to be generous, 3 to 5 minutes to stage everything, run 75 yards and back. That's a football field and a half of running. And to not be, like, totally, like, out of breath. And right. Also, she was only wearing, like, a big nightshirt. That was the only thing that she was wearing. As to go down that alleyway, you had to pass, like, 5 to 6 different homes and risk being seen by somebody.
Right.
I mean, albeit it was 2:30 in the morning or whatever, and very few people are up at that time. But still, it just strongly suggests a second person.
Mm-hmm.
Darlie's appeal attorney, along with the print, is having the sock retested, as I said. And many people theorize that, like a lot of internet sleuths, are theorizing that, oh, like this could suggest, like, that maybe this was the intent of sexual assault. Like, have we tested that the sock had chloroform on it?
Mm-hmm.
It would explain the deep sleep that Darlie had while the boys were stabbed. And sleeping through her own throat being cut, because mm-hmm. in no point of her statement did she say, and then he slashed my throat. It's right. Like she kind of woke up and she already had these injuries. And also, apparently, her underwear was missing when she woke up. She wasn't wearing any panties.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It would suggest, like, hey, maybe a person went up to the house, saw her sleeping on the couch, decided that they were going to sexually assault her. When they came in, they didn't know that the boys were sleeping on the floor, found the boys, killed them so that he could have mom to himself. And most often people who suffer from sexual assault, it is someone that they know, though rare, it could have been just a perfect stranger.
Right.
It's not like it's never happened. And this is also, and I do have to say, though, while this is an interesting theory, and while somebody could have entered the home with that intent, what writes off the sock being any part of that plot is that they did determine that the sock came from the Routier's home. Like those same sock fibers were found inside of one of Darren's workout shoes or running shoes. Sorry, internet sleuths, but...
Can you really, though, determine that it's like, oh, this is an exact sock from this home and not just, like, the same brand?
I mean, that's true. I don't know. That is possible, but they say that it was, you know, they're able to identify that it came from the Routier home.
I would tell be her they interested did that, in knowing how you can determine.
I could not find a lot of information on that. I actually, the only way I heard about that too was through a like one TV special from ABC called Last Defense, where I'm like, oh, like, because I actually had to update my notes because I had already written this whole thing about the chloroform. Like, oh, like the sock should be tested for chloroform or some sort of like, you know, agent to knock her out. And then I heard that and I'm like, well, if that's actually true, that the sock came from the Routier home, then that kind of writes that off. But that doesn't totally write off somebody trying to sexually assault her.
And it also just still
kind of remains a weird mystery.
They could have used the sock to temporarily just like knock her out. They don't have to use chloroform. They could have had it over her mouth to make her
pass out. Yeah, or like use it as a gag. But I don't think they found like Darlene's DNA on it, which then if you're going to argue that she was the one that planted it, shouldn't you find some of Darlene's DNA in it? But also just seems like such a weird... Again, it's 75 yards away next to a trash can over a drainage opening. Like, why, if you're trying to be like, oh, the person definitely ran out, why not just throw it out in the yard? Why not use the knife instead that actually had the blood on it? It just seems like a weird, like, somebody, they were lucky that somebody noticed it. You know? And it was like, it wasn't like it was completely soaked in blood like a lot of people describe when you see the photos. It was like somebody took this sock and dabbed, like there was a few like spots of blood and dabbed like blood from each boy and then left it. Honestly, I'm surprised that they found it. I know that they were like combing through because obviously they had to, you know, do that. But it just seems like a very... Winston way of thinking from New Girl. Like, I'm gonna leave this sock here behind this trash can.
Yeah,
I don't know, especially if like if let's say Darlie did self-inflict those wounds and she went so extra with that, but then she's just gonna leave this one sock. Like, it's just a very weird, I don't know, detail, and for me is very unexplained. Now, this is a very interesting little turn of events that they discovered later. Years after conviction, there was an affidavit signed by Darren that apparently the conversation, that adult conversation just about bills and her upcoming trip that they had, it really wasn't as matter of fact as that. Apparently, on that night, Darren stated that Darlie had brought up separation and that it was actually the third time that she had brought up separation. The first time she had brought it up, he took a gun to himself and to his head and said that he was going to kill himself if she left him. The second time she brought up wanting to separate, he took the gun and held it to her head and said that he would kill her if she tried to leave. And you're going to tell me that after those two very intense reactions to her wanting to separate, the third time she brings it up, he's just going to be like, okay, well, let's just talk about it tomorrow. I'm going to go to sleep. I really think that they should have looked at Darren a little more. They obviously, the police did consider Darren, but I feel like they wrote him off way too quickly. Darren also in this affidavit admitted to insurance fraud, that he had set up, worked with people basically to steal one of his cars for the insurance money, and that he had been actively talking to people to stage a robbery to claim for insurance money and then get the stuff later back from the person and split the profits with the person. Again, there's that $22,000 debt that Darlene and Darren were facing, and that Darlie didn't even seem very worried about, but Darren for sure was, especially if he was looking into insurance fraud. There's also to note that Darlie had a $250,000 life insurance on her. So Darren was looking shady upon Darlie's arrest, actually. And he brought a lawyer who repped him before and basically said, this is the flaw of, like, the defense team. Like, why didn't they do more for Darlie? He brought in the lawyer to say, defend my wife, but don't bring, if you hire me, I won't bring up any of this. Mm-hmm. Or the fact that he helped defend Darren against the insurance fraud. And that about the life insurance. So Darlie didn't find out about this until many years after being on death row. And she felt totally betrayed. She got her own defense team. And she has appealed her case several times. There's also different instances of, like, reasons of why this should be appealed. But each appeal has been denied. Like, the court recorder made 1,800 or more significant errors on the transcripts.
Whoa.
Yeah. But her appeal was denied then. And since 2008, her defense team focused on the physical evidence for an appeal that will stick. Like print, like that fingerprint that didn't match Darlie or Darren.
Now, what's caused Darren to submit this affidavit all these years later?
You know, I'm not entirely sure, actually, but the affidavit does exist. Mm-hmm. There's also the argument of, you know, with Darlie having that much of life insurance on her, was he looking to have his wife killed? He knew that she had been sleeping downstairs and probably told the person. And it's just like the one night that the person decided to appear was the one night that the boys were sleeping downstairs with her. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's also a very interesting piece, not of evidence, but a statement that was taken from a neighbor that was in the same, that lived in the same neighborhood as Darlie. It wasn't like a right next door neighbor, but she was like a block down or something. There was this woman who was up late. She was watching a horror film just at home. She was like home alone. And she heard somebody trying to come in through a front door. So she went up to her front door, looked through the peephole, and turned on the porch light. And she saw two men that she did not recognize. And they both ran off. And she was really freaked out. But then, I don't know, this girl has nerves of steel or something. But then nonetheless, just like went back to watching her scary movie. And she didn't think much of it. She didn't call the police. And then the movie ends. It's around 1 a.m. And she's going to bed. And in her bedroom window, she sees one of the men that she saw in her front door peering in through her window. And then when he sees that he's been made, he runs off. She still doesn't call the police. I don't know. I don't understand why. Maybe it was one of those like bystander effects or where she's like, I live in such a safe neighborhood and I'm okay. Like it could have just been, I don't know why you wouldn't call the police. But it was after she woke up the next day and heard about Darlie and the boys that she then went up to the police and told them. And they very conveniently just decided to totally ignore her story. They never looked into it. Other neighbors of Darlie and Darren for days actually reported seeing a black car cruising through the neighborhood. And this was a pretty tight-knit group of neighbors. They all pretty much knew each other. And I feel like once you live in an area for a time, you start to recognize unfamiliar cars, right? Yeah. There was a slew of statements from neighbors that reported a black sedan or a dark blue sedan, this and that. And actually, Darlie and Darren's across the street neighbor from her house saw this black car parked in front of her sidewalk, staring very intently at the Routier home. And she was obviously very suspicious. And so she got out of her house and was going to walking towards this car to question this guy, like, can I help you or something? But as soon as this guy saw that, you know, he was, that she was approaching him, he then like very quickly sped off. Mm-hmm. And this again was something that the police ignored. And in all the files of Darlie's case that are available to the public, I'll say, there is no evidence that they ever looked into any of these. Like, none, they did not look into many leads other than, like, looking into Darren for a little bit and then being like, no, it's probably the mom because, you know, Darlie's, nothing's adding up or, you know, there it feels just like Susan Smith, and they just really had tunnel vision, I think, on Darlie. Yeah. But yeah, so where is Darlie now? She's still on death row. They are still waiting on the result of the print. She is held at Mountain View Unit in Gatesville, Texas, which is like a maximum security facility. Her and Darren actually divorced in 2011, but he did make a statement. He's like, this has nothing to do with me second guessing her innocence. Like, he absolutely maintains her innocence as mm-hmm. well to this day. And he's like, you know, it just, I just needed to like move on. She is now 52 years old and she remains on death row today. And so, you know, whether she did it or not, we can't ever be too sure with the information we currently have right now. But yeah, it just kind of is one of those cases that even though we have somebody convicted and on death row for it, it really remains a mystery. We may never really know until maybe we get back the results of the DNA test for the print.
Even then, even if they get that back, I feel like there's just so much information that casts that reasonable doubt that she mm-hmm. should not be on death row for that.
Oh, yeah. And they've made so many appeals, her and her defense team. And each one of them have been denied.
That just sounds like a bad trial. She had a bad trial. I mean, to not mm-hmm. have all the evidence and to have, you know, not call into question the integrity of the police officers, that they aren't biased based off of, you know, news reports of other stories or, there's their lack of exposure to crimes like that. How do they know that they are covering all their bases? Like,
and I mean, just like the prosecution team, the way that they painted her and the way that they reasoned everything of like how she's definitely the one that did it, blah blah blah, is very much based on her character. They basically like called her like a Dallas bimbo that wanted to keep her lavish lifestyle and saw the boys as in her way, and it was really just like
bizarre. It was like about her boys gonna get in the way.
I mean, I'm like, well, you said it yourself. She's about to go on a trip to Mexico. That, you know, her boys were obviously not stopping her from doing that.
Exactly.
And she hadn't slowed down her spending, so it wasn't like, you know, like, oh, the boys have made me really, you know, pinch pennies here. Like, she wasn't pinching pennies.
Right.
So that argument just doesn't pan out. Now, I am very much of, you know, somewhere in the middle. Maybe it wasn't a total random intruder. I think it was something to do with the husband, Darren, having worked with shady people, and that whatever sort of, whether it was killing Darlie for insurance or staging a robbery for insurance fraud, it just was like a botched operation that went super bad.
See, I think would know be that like the... I could go that far because I would want more information on what did he do previously, what led to him and that affidavit, why did he not say it then if it was going to clear his wife, why did he wait until now, and is it potentially to help her in an appeal to cast even more doubt that she actually is guilty. I would want more information from him on all that.
One part that I didn't include in my notes, and I don't know why, I probably was just like enthralled watching it on the special and forgot to type it down. But when Darlie was arrested, he started reaching out to people to speak for them publicly. And he found this, God, I wish I could remember the guy's name. I really wish I wrote this down. And maybe somebody can, I'll probably look it up after the recording of this. But he reached out to this guy who is basically just like this millionaire, or like super rich guy. And he had like a very public platform of working to help defend those wrongly accused. Mm-hmm. Darren reached out to this man. And he's like, okay, like, let's look into it and let's get a PI to gather our own evidence that doesn't have the bias of the police. And they had him, Darren, go through a polygraph test. And it showed that anything after him saying that Darren was his name was deception.
Everything.
So questions like, you know, did you kill the boys? No. Did something happen that night? Do you know who came into the into your home? No, I don't know. Do you have any idea who could have done this? I have no idea. All of those questions came out as deception. The one question that came out not deception is Darlie innocent? And he said, my wife had nothing to do with this. And that one didn't come out as deception. But everything having to do with like himself and his involvement that night was fishy. And this rich guy dropped him. And polygraph tests aren't admissible in court.
Mm-hmm.
But so it wasn't really, it couldn't have been brought to court to use really to defend Darlie. But it was enough for him to be like, this guy is fishy enough where I don't know if I should help him out.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it seems like his wife is wrongly accused. But there was enough. He basically, in the interview, they got the guy. God, why can't I remember his name? They got the guy and interviewed them and asked him, like, what did he think of Darren? And he's like, me and my investigative team came to the conclusion that Darren is a pathological liar and he is hiding something. And for that, we would not work with him.
Pathological liar. Interesting. I'd be interested to see, like, all the questions they asked him, just to see, like, what else, you know.
Yes, I do want to try to find, like, I don't know how we could get our hands on that transcript when it was, like, privately done.
Yeah, it's probably not available.
Exactly, so... Yeah, who knows if this guy is even telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he's not willing to divulge, like, the information, the transcripts, the test results for this polygraph, is he maybe, you know, just saying it to get some sort of notoriety? I don't know.
Because even then, that almost is like, why wouldn't you take that to exonerate the wife, but also be like, clearly my evidence shows this man may be the actual killer. Wouldn't you want him to be in jail?
Right? Yeah. So, I don't know. Just a little side note. Mm-hmm. Maybe something for our internet sleuths to look into. But I found it a very interesting note. I think there's way more to Darren than what police were willing to look into. Mm-hmm. Or worked to look into.
There's just more to all of it that they clearly didn't want to look into.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I don't know. I just have this, like, inkling that Darren was cooking something up, hired people. He's hiring shady people into his home thinking that, oh, it'll all work out and I'll get my insurance money, whether that's a robbery or killing my wife. But I don't want to know when it happens so that he can have enough reasonable doubt. And it happened. It just happened on a night where his wife and his boys were all downstairs and his boys perished.
He should have, at the very least, made declarations of, you know, if it's not to kill his wife, if it's just a robbery, don't touch my kids. Like, there's no murder. And maybe wait till his wife is gone on her trip to Mexico.
Well, the boys' insurance, they didn't have a lot in insurance, the boys. So, you know, there were some people that were arguing like, oh, Darlie killed the boys for their insurance money.
No, I don't
but think she did that. I think they had like $5,000 each.
Mm-hmm.
And so that only just covered the funeral expenses. So they didn't get any profit from that.
Right. Right.
Also, I just want to say, it just breaks my heart, but like, they had the boys buried together in a casket holding hands, and I just...
Oh, God.
And that was one reason why they couldn't exhume the bodies when they found that print to get their prints later, was because they were clasping hands, and then the coffin leaked, so the water damaged, like, there was no prints to get from them when they realized that they had never gotten the boys' prints. So that's why they're relying on that DNA evidence to be able to tell them whether it was somebody in the Routier family or not.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Even without the boys, I mean, if you're looking for DNA, they just need the parents to get at least like an idea if it's.
Well, right. You know, I mean, they're relying on DNA because they'll for sure be able to see, like, if it's one of the parents or somebody related to the parents, which would, you know, be the boys, or if it's none of the Routiers, DNA speaking, then right. They know there was somebody that night from outside the home, and they can then prove that somebody there was indeed an intruder. Unfortunately, Darlie's statements never gave anything specific about the appearance of the intruder. It was just like this white man with bushy hair wearing dark clothes,
mm-hmm.
which actually is sort of consistent with the gal that was watching the horror movie.
Right.
One of the two men, like, I guess there was one that was like chubbier and another one that was like in a tracksuit and had bushy hair. But a lot of people have bushy hair too.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot of white guys with bushy hair out there. But yeah, it's very, very interesting, too, once you go down the rabbit hole of the, like, psychoanalysis of the words that she chooses in her 911 call. It is interesting that she says they instead of he. So when in her initial call, she says, they came in and they stabbed my boys. Like, it was more than one intruder. Or, like, she was just speaking, genderlessly to somebody, right?
I could see, and I could see someone using words like they if they were in that state of still coming to, or mm-hmm. were it maybe, what's the word? In shock?
Yeah, sure. There's a lot of things I think in shock is
removing yourself from whatever just happened. That using words like they instead of he or she could certainly indicate that.
Because sometimes I say they, like, oh, like they left their like coat here, when I know that like it's a he or a she,
mm-hmm.
but it just kind of slips. But I don't know if that's like embedded in me because of the social culture that we're in now, where people are identifying as they, them.
See, I know I've used they in terms of if it's involving a person, I don't know. Even if I knew it was a he or she, I'm more likely to use they simply because I don't know who they are. If I was out in public somewhere and I was at a restaurant and someone left a coat on their chair at the table next to me, and you know, the waiter came by, I'd be like, oh, they left their coat here is what I would
Someone
use.
Left their coat. Yeah.
Yeah. Like mm-hmm. whether it was, you know, I knew for sure it was a he or she, I would use they. Whereas if, you know, it was like a friend of mine that I randomly saw and then they left, I'd be like, oh, shoot. You know, like, let's say it's our friend, Darren, like he left his coat. Like there's just mm-hmm. there's some sort of like connection or disconnect between like,
I guess,
identifying like that if you know them or not.
There's like an argument either way of like, well, if she saw that it was a man, wouldn't she use the he, him pronouns when discussing this intruder? Or is she like traumatically removed from the situation and this person is such an unknown? Like she's like how you said, like she's just coming to that. She's just saying they because their identity is so unknown.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's a lot of videos out there and like articles of people very like hyper fixating and just like totally like splitting hairs and analyzing that whole call. It is a long call. It's just under 6 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say that there are some things like some of her behavior that is bizarre, like her response to when she was being questioned and accused of murdering her boys. Like, well, if I killed them, I don't remember. And yes, she could have been saying it incredulously, but not following up with anything else. Or the night of when she was being instructed to do certain things by police, but she wasn't doing them. She just was stuck in like hysterics.
Mm-hmm.
Which you could say, well, she was just being hysterical because she lost her kids, but she never asked how she can help her kids. It's kind of always about like saying what happened and identifying who it was. Like, I get it. Like, there are things that feel off, but there is enough reasonable doubt where we should try to cast a broader net than what police actually mm-hmm. did.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, anywho, that is my true crime story. I can't believe we're already like at a minute 40 here, or an hour 40.
Minute 40.
So yeah, what do you guys think? Comment on the section below. No. I will try to include some photos. I won't include like any like victim photos of like the kids or anything, but I think to get your eyes on like Darlie's injuries.
Mm-hmm.
I'll put that on Instagram because like you'll see these bruises and like the gash and the cut, like the gash on her neck, the cut on her arm. I can't believe that they in court said that they were just superficial. Like I'm incredulous.
I'm honestly not shocked. I think certain court systems are very against, you know, whoever the defense is. Fuck it, they're guilty. It just mm-hmm. seems like, who cares? They think you're guilty? Okay, cool. Yeah, you're guilty. Yeah, facts I don't think always matter in court when they should.
Yeah, well, anywho, that was today's story. I hope that you all enjoyed today's episode and that you are looking forward to the changes that we have coming up in the podcast. I know change is kind of like, it can be like scary or, you know, people like things the way that they are, but mm-hmm. I think overall it's not going to actually change that much. And if anything, you know, we're doing this to take care of ourselves. And I know that our listeners are always pretty supportive of us, you know, doing self-care and taking time when we need it. And I think this is really going to be, these changes are going to be very helpful for the two of us. So that this podcast stays as a passion that we really enjoy doing and not like a, you know, burdensome thing that's burning us out. We really definitely don't want it to get to that point. But just to recap, we are going to be posting episodes on Sundays now. We are going to be rolling out episodes for the first 4 Sundays of the month, which a lot of months that will be every week. But if there's a 5th Sunday of the month, we are going to be taking that 5th Sunday off. So we just have a handful of built-in breaks throughout the year. We'll be doing witchy, spooky, witchy listeners. So our listeners is no longer on the 13th of the month. It will now be on the fourth Sunday of the month. And our paranormal, our spooky episodes will be just kind of how this one is, just one person telling a story at a time and doing kind of a more of a deeper dive.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're really happy to be back from this break. And I don't know if you have any other words, Laura.
Not really. I'm excited to move forward and bring some fun episodes for everyone.
Awesome. So if you would like to connect with us online, we are on social media. We are at The New Witches everywhere. If you are interested in becoming a Patreon member, we spoke about our patrons. We give them exclusive benefits every month, as well as access to exclusive content on both Patreon, but you're also invited to our private Facebook group and added to our close friends list on Instagram. Lots of cool things to check out there. That's patreon.com/thenewwitches. If you're interested in submitting a story or question for an upcoming listener stories episode, different ways to do that, go to our website, thenewwitches.com, and fill out our submission form on our contact page. Or you can email us directly at thenewwitches@gmail.com. Lastly, you can also call in your question or story. Our Google Voice mailbox is 707-559-8111. Again, that's a voicemail box. It goes straight to voicemail. You don't have to talk to anybody, and you have up to 3 minutes to leave your story or question. And please rate and review us on whatever listening platform you are hearing us through. We really appreciate it. Not only does it help, you know, our ratings, which is awesome, of course, but also helps us... we really do read that feedback, and we always appreciate constructive criticism, or if there's something that we're doing great at that you want more of, it just lets us know how we're doing with the podcast. So that's everything, I'm pretty sure. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I'm Maria.
I'm Laura.
And you've been listening to The New Witches. Stay witchy.
Keep it creepy.
Bye.